You can use mine.
Hi, welcome to Beth Israel for the first in a series of three classes on Reconstructionist thought and history and process. Tonight, Rabbi Helen Plotkin is going to get us to the historical beginnings. Is that a good thought about it?
Yes.
And then next week, Rabbi Linda is going to do something else.
She's going to talk about prayer from a Reconstructionist perspective.
And the third week, Rabbi Nathan is going to, I think, walk us through some process.
Right, talk about
how community works.
Within the Reconstructionist world.
And I'm going to pass the microphone around and try to find some batteries for the other one. And so introduce yourselves. I'm Marion, and I am one of two adult ed chairs. And this is...
Richard, the other chair.
Great. So we'll start over here.
Thank you. So I guess I should introduce Bob. This is Bob Stone, everyone.
They don't know me.
And who's that? You've got to introduce me.
Oh, this is Wendy Waterson.
Huh?
Do this
with your hand.
This is Wendy Waterson.
Nice job.
Okay. Thank you. I'm glad I'm performing well.
This is still Bob Stone. This is Jerry Ellman. I'm Miriam Sigler. This is the mic.
Behind me is Marion Hammermish, and I'm Joyce Romoff.
Next to me is Alan Feldman.
Introduce me.
Hey. Andy.
Let me introduce Debbie Patrick.
And this is Larry Hammermesh.
And Debbie to my left, and this is Jennifer to my right. Oh, and I'm Debbie here.
I'll just say that I'm Jennifer.
I'm Shoshana, and I don't know your name, so I can't tell you.
Robin.
And this is Alan.
I'm Robin's husband, Al.
And I'm Amy.
Well, welcome, everybody. Let's start learning.
So this is a modification of a talk I actually gave in a class at Swarthmore on world religions. And so if it turns into something too academic, you'll stop me. I don't want to be boring, I find the subject matter interesting, but if I get, like, pedantic, you'll stop me. Okay. So what I wanted to talk about, so the idea is Reconstructionism, from where this comes. And, you know, like, we have this sense that the movements, as we know them, are kind of set in stone, and they are what they are, and they always were, or maybe orthodoxy used to exist, and then some other things came, and it gradually there was... People have different sort of assumptions about how it all happened. But the story is actually one that I think is really important for us to understand, which is a story... I mean, actually, let me find... I mean, so all of the forms of Judaism that we encounter in the United States of America today have their roots in a certain upheaval that took place in Europe called modernity. And it was a shattering of the old patterns of how things worked. And it's not the first time Judaism changed. Judaism has always changed, and it has responded to the scientific and social zeitgeist of the world that it lived in. This is true about the Bible relative to Babylonian and Canaanite mythology. This is true about the Mishnah relative to Roman law, and this is true about Maimonides, relative to the Aristotelian science of his day brought to the Iberia by the Arabs. So I'm going to start at a particular point and talk about a particular upheaval that kind of lands on us. But it just don't think that before that, Judaism was one uniform thing, okay? It has always changed. Now, what I just said is probably the most Reconstructionist thing I believe, so just flash forward, but that you cannot understand what Judaism is without understanding the evolution of this civilization that we call Judaism. So I want to stretch this to sort of sketch the story of this shattering in a way that points to the beginnings of Reconstructionism in the first half of the 20th century. And you'll notice that I'm really going to deflect the question of believing in God. That's not going to be the center of what I talk about. I'm going to start with talking about pre-modern Europe. And I'm going to talk about pre-modern Europe in terms of corporate structures, that life was organized in corporate structures and people were not so much understood as individuals as they were understood as parts of a whole. The upheaval that came with modernity was the upheaval that made the individual primary. The primacy of the individual and the corollary of that, that the individual is essentially free. That's the big upheaval that happened everywhere and that affected everybody. And so I wanted to look at briefly at the Jewish responses to this in Eastern Europe, which is basically Hasidism and its opponents and secularism and Marxism, although I'm really not going to talk about Marxism, and I'm really not going to talk about Zionism, and I'm not going to talk about anything except Central and Eastern Jewish, the Jewish world, Northern, Central, and Eastern, right? I'm not going to talk about the Mediterranean Rim. I'm not going to talk about Sephardi and Mizrahi Judaism. So I'm leaving out a lot, but I'm going to try to tell something of a coherent story that kind of lands where we are. So I'm going to spend more time talking about the responses in Western Europe, which lead to Reform and Orthodoxy, and then eventually conservative Judaism and sort of Jewish studies as a thing, as a way to be Jewish, kind of what we're doing. And then we're going to end up in America, and we're going to talk a little bit about Mordechai Kaplan and how he is different from these other changes that happen. So first, you know, to get a sense of pre-modern Europe, when I say it was made of corporate structures, this was true in many areas of life. So how would you say that, what's feudalism? How is feudalism different from the way we live?
In a feudalist society, the individual is the least important, and the importance is the hierarchy and the sort of the power relationships between different people who the different levels of the hierarchy. That's how I understand it.
So one understands oneself in terms of where one fits in to various hierarchies. So you have the king, and you have nobles, and you have peasants. And the obligation to serve in the military, the obligation to pay taxes, those fall on the nobles, right? And they make their decisions about how to distribute those obligations among the people below them. Right, so so in very concrete, real ways, your relationship to the government is mediated through a structure that each one can be different and can be structured completely differently. So in the area of religion, so that's social and economic life. In the area of religion, you had Roman Catholicism. The church is hierarchical, and the priests are intermediaries, and they're the only ones who could read the text. They read the Latin texts, right? And your understanding of that was really beholden to their understanding of that. It was really inaccessible to the common people. And the church itself was also deeply integrated with the state. So to be not Christian was to be not completely a member of the state. And to be a member of both of those things was to be part of an organic whole. So for the Jews, like everybody else, the relationship between the individual and the state was mediated through corporate structures, right? So in Western and Central Europe, the Jews lived in ghettos. The word, it's a community that is walled. Some historians say the walls of the ghetto were locked from inside as well as from outside, right? And it wasn't, and some of these ghettos were terrible places to live, and some of these ghettos were beautiful places with plenty of wealth and plenty of resources to go around. Probably less so the shtetls of Central and Eastern Europe, which you know, you can get your picture from Fiddler on the Roof, Tevye and all that, you know. So but both of these were communities that were made up of Jews, and the both from looking out and looking in, the community was the unit of analysis much more than the individual. It's really hard for us to really grasp this. I mean, you just didn't leave your community, right? And you didn't choose your community. You just were part of it. And so looking out, the ways in which that community was a corporate structure, the community related to the state as a unit, kind of like the feudal communities. An example of that is taxes. So one of the historians that I read talks about how inside the shtetl and inside the ghetto walls, there was a great deal of internal autonomy, right? So the Jews owed taxes to the state, but how they divided that obligation up within the community was their own business. That's the looking out piece. Looking in, they're self-governing. So they ran their own law courts, and they ran them through they were responsible for courts of law that both met Jewish law and the law of the state. But they had to actually, they had to show that they were meeting the law of their own community, actually. And it was an entire picture. It's what I want to call this organic Jewishness. Religious, social, legal, cultural, ethical, culinary, linguistic, sartorial, how you dressed, right? And maybe most important, education. So one of the things that existed within these communities is charity. Well, I mean, and if you read the legal texts on charity, there's all this stuff about how you need three people to go collect charity, or need two people to collect charity and three people to give it out. Very, very careful rules about how it's collected, how much people are expected to give. It's like a safety net, bless you. It's the safety net. It's the welfare system, right? So there. So all of these government functions, what we think of as government functions, were handled internally, but they weren't separated from all these other issues. So, for example, communal prayer. Prayer was understood communally. Now, we all see the remnants of that in the way we pray, but, and you know, like most of our liturgy is in the we form, right? And so the emphasis was on salvation of the Jewish people as a whole and of the world as a whole, but not so much let me be saved, right? It wasn't about that. It was about salvation at the level of the community. Another very interesting thing is that it was like in Europe, there were all these communities living in their own little bubble, another bubble among the many bubbles that related to the state as a unit, but they all had something in common. So there was a network of connections, of family ties, of business ties between these communities. So it was almost like a nation that existed instead of having a land, it existed as a web of connections between all these other individual little communities. So it actually ended up being kind of useful to some of the sovereign states because the Jews could affect business transactions across national boundaries in ways that, this is an aside, it doesn't have anything to do with our topic, it's just an interesting point. So Judaism was not what we would think of as a religion. There's a book by Leora Betnitsky at Princeton. She wrote a book called How Judaism Became a Religion, right? It wasn't what we would call a religion. It wasn't a confession of belief, right? It was an entire way of life. And one of the symbols of that is that there was a common language, right? All across, you know, from Germany to the whole Pale of Settlement in Russia, everybody spoke Yiddish. It's so strange. Wherever they lived, they all could communicate with each other. There were dialects, there were different accents, there were strong vocabulary differences, but they all shared this. What were you going to say?
I used to work at Martin's Run, and when I started there, there were survivors. I mean, there were some non-Jewish people, but those who were living when I started there in 1991 were mostly survivors, and they would sit at mealtime or at entertainment time. They'd sit in a room, and although they all had spoken Yiddish, and a lot of them still remembered Yiddish from, you know, 90 years ago, they couldn't understand one another. So, and I was told, even living in the same country, whatever that country might have been called, from village to village, they could not understand one another's Yiddish. That was their memory of it.
There were some quite different dialects, but still there was some level of unity that tied those things together. And it's interesting.
Did they write at that time the Yiddish language? Because that would unify them.
They wrote, Yiddish could be written, was written in, with Hebrew letters, and Ladino was Spanish written with Hebrew letters, and Judeo-Arabic was Arabic written with Hebrew letters. Very, and when my kids were in were in Hebrew school, they used to pass notes in regular school in English written in Hebrew letters. But women often learned Yiddish as their written language. But the language of study and prayer was always Hebrew. It was not the colloquial language, but it was the proper language. Certainly in pre-Enlightenment times, Hebrew was the language of writing, by and large. So far. What I've tried to do is just give a sense of how different it was to be Jewish, to be a Jew, right? And this is, was it you that sent out the link to the essay or interview on is the word Jew an acceptable word? Well, you can sort of understand that question in these terms. Like, if you're a Jew, that's like being an Italian or being a, right? You're a very different thing. If you're Jewish, you know, I think that's much more like being Christian or, you know, that's your religious identification. And to call somebody a Jew has that implication that they're other, that they're part of a different community. And that was the truth. And it's much less the truth now. So what I want to know is, how does that come to be, that is no longer what we experience? And so there's this upheaval that takes place in which the individual takes primacy over tradition. And the way it begins, you might say, is with the Protestant Revolution that goes all the way back to Martin Luther in 1517, who translated the Bible into German, right? Now, why is that so revolutionary?
German is, in a sense, a colloquial language. It's not a sacred language that's the property of only a few. It's what the German people spoke.
Yes.
So they could understand the revelation of the Bible for themselves.
Right. And actually, I guess one point that I should have made, when I mentioned education, I didn't talk about that quite enough. When the Jews took care of education, the contrast between the way the Jews handled that and the way the Catholic Church handled that is really striking. In the Jewish community, everybody knew Hebrew. Even the girls knew some Hebrew, but definitely all the boys knew Hebrew. They were educated. They were expected to be able to make meaningful connection to the sacred texts in the sacred language. Everybody. I mean, so there was just this such a much higher expectation of literacy. And of ownership of that corporate piece. So it's really interesting because what it means is that within the Jewish bubble, there really wasn't hierarchy in the way there was within the Catholic bubble and within the bubble of nobles. And there was very little hierarchy of that kind. And so when Martin Luther translates the Bible into German, that is deeply revolutionary because it means now each person in the Christian world can expect to have their own relationship with an interpretation of the sacred text. Take the thing.
I always thought that in the Jewish community there was always the rabbis at the top, and then there were the learneds in the middle, and then the men, and then the women. And the
well,
I mean, I thought it was pretty stratified, actually.
There was some of that, but there was very, very different. Everybody was educated. Every child went to cheder. Every child could read Hebrew. And there were the super educated and the, you know, it's not that there wasn't any hierarchy, but it wasn't like, and you were, every single person is a valid member of the of the minion, every even man, right? Is a about every. I mean, you know, I mean, we don't have to argue that out. We know that story. But every man was a member of, was a valid man. Every man could lead services, and they did, and they knew how to. I mean, compared to the rest of the world, that isn't to say there weren't leaders and there weren't, you know, fighting over prestige and everything else, but it wasn't a built-in hierarchy. Now, I think one of the things you're thinking, well, we're going to get to one of the responses that you're, that I think you're going to find interesting in this regard. So, yeah. Okay, I'm as we get to each thing, I have the years. So far we're in 1517, okay. Right? And
thank you.
And the Protestant Revolution, and then one of the big moments for me that I just find really fascinating is this thing called the Peace of Westphalia. So they have the 30 Years' War and the 80 Years' War, and all these kingdoms are fighting it out. Right, the Roman Empire is in charge. Catholicism, the hierarchy, is in charge. And all these Protestant groups are at war trying to establish their own, the dominance of their way of thinking. The Peace of Westphalia, so what you had before that was Roman Catholicism over everything and pockets of rebellion, of protestation from the Protestants, and with the Peace of Westphalia, they all said, you know what, we're going to turn that upside down. The basic structure of the world is going to change. We're going to have every kingdom be able to decide whether they want to be Roman Catholic or Protestant, right? Catholic means universal, right? So this is an overturning of that, so that now if you're Catholic, that's within everybody doing, each kingdom doing their own thing. So while there is still plenty of Catholicism and plenty of Roman Catholicism, it's no longer Catholic. Right now it's the choice of the ruler of a particular little kingdom within Europe. So that's a huge overturning, where the idea of not individuals yet, but, well, even, I mean, as the Protestants, the Protestant idea was that each individual has their own, relationship. So this change also happened in philosophy, and this, I mean, I want to call this science, really. This is the scientific, the beginning, the seeds of the revolution of science, right? So you have Descartes. Listen to this. I think, therefore I am, right? He's bringing, I mean, this is such a revolutionary idea, to bring the first meaning of being into your own self, your own brain. Spinoza might be the first modern Jew. I have a quote from Spinoza here. So Spinoza, the reason I think he's the first modern Jew, so he's in the 1600s, and he is the first Jew we know of who walked, there were always people who left the Jewish community to go become part of some other community, to convert to Catholicism, to Christianity, or to Islam, or right, but he left the Jewish community to be nothing. That was an amazing thing, and he's the first guy to do that. And he wrote to a Catholic friend in 1675, "I know that I understand the true philosophy. If you ask me in what way I know it, I answer, in the same way as you know that the three angles of a triangle are equal to two right angles. That this is sufficient will be denied by no one whose brain is sound and who does not go dreaming of evil spirits inspiring us with false ideas like the true, For the truth is the index of itself and of what is false. So for him, both Judaism and Catholicism were based on dreaming of evil spirits and not on rational thought. So rationality was deductive. You figured it out in your head. I just want to ask, say, a scientist in the room, whether that's science. Is that anything like contemporary science? What's missing? Right. Empiricism, it's not empirical. It's deductive, but it's basically rational, and it's internal, and it's you who is the judge. And your internal life. So Kant extends this to ethics. And he says, dare to know, have the courage to use your own understanding. So this is in religion, in philosophy, and in social and political structures, the aristocracy gives way to equal citizenship for all. You have the French Revolution, right, in which you can no longer say, let them eat cake. Now you have to actually pay attention to the individual French people. And the emancipation of the Jews in France in 1791 begins a process of that ends with emancipation. So what does that mean? What does that mean, emancipation? Freeing. So what did they get freed from? Absolutely. And they, yeah.
They were freed from the corporate structure that they had been defined by.
That's right. So they were no longer a Jew. They were a French person who was Jewish. Mm-hmm. Right? And that is the big change in emancipation. And so the... So the gates of the shtetl, the gates of really of the ghetto in this case, because most of this happened in Western Europe. So the gates of the ghetto are open. Jews can serve in the military, and Jews can act as individuals. They have voting rights. They can act as individuals and not buffered only through that corporate structure of the Jewish community. I mean, somebody who's got the history of the French Revolution handy. Go ahead. Take the mic. I need help here.
I do not know much about it, but as far as I know, Napoleon Bonaparte he said, if Jewish people are going to be part of our society, they have to be equal partners, and they have to take equal responsibility as every individual in the society.
So Napoleon So really the first short answer is Napoleon. And it's in that period, but also the entire history of the French Revolution and in other countries, although I think in 1963 or something, the Jews of New Hampshire were officially emancipated. I looked at a list and they had all these countries and when the Jews were emancipated and they had New Hampshire. I don't remember exactly what. apparently it was a state by state thing and they just never bothered to. There weren't enough Jews there to even. So. Right, exactly. So, emancipated, right.
What you just said though was so key. They were no longer Jews. They were French people who were Jewish. We're still battling with that today. Are we Jews or are we Americans who are Jewish?
And now look, read my highlighted item there. What does Jewishness mean outside the ghetto and the shtetl? Right? So that is the question. If you're going to be just a Frenchman of the Jewish persuasion, what is that? And it never was that before. So it's really It's a big deal trying to figure this out. So what is authentic Judaism in a world that cultivates the value of the individual as a force separate from group structures like family, community, nation slash people, right? That is the question. What is authentic Judaism in a world outside the shtetl and the ghetto?
Yes.
So, in Eastern Europe, and this is where, okay, so in Eastern Europe, there were, I listed here three different responses to the problem, right? To what now there's, how are the Jews going to organize themselves? How are the Jews going to define themselves? What is Jewish identity going to be, right? And it doesn't, you know, it's not like people sat down and, this is a historical review that, you know, and I can, what I want to say is Hasidism, its opposite Mitnagdism, which literally means the opponents, right? Which, that's how they defined themselves, as the opponents of Hasidism. And the secular Yiddishist movement, the Eastern European Enlightenment, all of those things, and I would add Marxism, you know, and socialism and Bundism and all those things too, but I'm not going to go into those. But just because, I mean, partly because I really want to talk about the things that when we look around, we say, oh yeah, that's Jewish. Although, you know, Bundism and Marxism and secular Yiddishism, that is one of the things we look around and say, oh, that's one of the forms of being Jewish. Well, it had its roots here. It was, you know, oh, a nation is something that has its own language, its own literature. Let's write literature in Yiddish. So people started writing poetry and modern and short stories, and there was a Yiddish enlightenment, right? They started going and teaching science in Yiddish, right? Let's define ourselves like the Frenchmen, only we're the Yids, right? The Yidden.
We should just say that this emancipation, the formal aspect of emancipation, propagated over time, so that in Eastern Europe, all this phenomena that happened in France is 50 years later, or in the case of the Pale of Settlement, it's not really till 1917. So it's just important to bear that in mind,
right,
too.
And that I'm kind of making a mishmash of the actual historical timeline. Thank you.
That's okay.
In order, you know, in the service of kind of a structural story that I want to tell, and also because it's not my strong point. Anyway, so I thank you. Keep me honest all the way. Because actually, Richard Remnick knows at least as much about this as I do, so please. Anyway, so Hasidism began in the early 1700s. Rabbi Israel Baal Shem Tov, meaning Rabbi Israel, the master of the good name, he was a pious mystic. And originally this was pious mystics living in the Ukraine. It spread across Poland, Russia, and Hungary. In what way is it, why would I call that a response to modernity? Well, there's actually a number of reasons. But the one that I would put out first is that it really focused on the spiritual life of the individual. There's actually a lot of other important pieces to that too. There was this charismatic Rebbe. The idea of this charismatic Rebbe, and some of that hierarchical stuff you're thinking of may actually come from this time and not from that time of real corporate Judaism. These were these charismatic Rebbes who gathered Chassidim, which is Chesed is devotion and steadfast love and loyal, loving devotion. And so the Hasidim that gathered around the Rebbe, they chose their Rebbe. And they would leave their family and make their way and sit in the court of that Rebbe and be his Hasid. And so this is a choice. You choose who your Rebbe is, and you go and you follow him. And at this point, workers and people who are not educated, it becomes harder and harder for everybody to hold on to education. This Hasidism, while the leaders were extremely educated, they left the way that they worshipped was all about joy and about individual and intimate connection with God, and they had ways of offerings for people who were not so educated. So it, in a way, created a new kind of hierarchy, but it also was a little bit more of a modern individualist way of thinking. The Mitnagdim, the opponents, saw the Hasidim as arrogant. They were desecrating tradition, and mostly because they allowed these new kinds of prayers that were ecstatic, and so these guys said, no, it's all about, and they invented the concept, the modern concept of the yeshiva, where you sit and you learn, and you just learn the traditional texts, and it doesn't even matter that much if you understand them, but you learn them and you argue them out, and you, or understand them sort of at a deep and personal and mystical level. You just, you know, figure out what they mean. And prayer and learning become this responsibility. They're not for the purpose of individual expansiveness, but they have this amazing idea that actually learning is what keeps the world from collapsing back in. Learning Talmud. So they, in the yeshivas, they would actually make sure there was somebody, a chavruta partnership, studying 24 hours a day, and they kept the world from reverting to tohu and vohu. Like Shavuot all year long, right. So these guys, so in the Yiddish Haskalah, we talked a little about this. What I most want to talk about is, I want to move to the responses in Western Europe, where you have the German Haskalah, and this actually mostly happens before. I just want to talk about the other one to get it out of the way. No, not really. I mean, Hasidism starts earlier. But so there's this guy named Moses Mendelssohn. As the Jews in Germany become emancipated, he has this idea that the job of the Jew is to be a Jew in the home and a human being on the street, right? And he says, I am not a Jew. I am a German of the Jewish persuasion. That's where that phrase comes from. I'm a German of the Jewish of the Mosaic persuasion, and the Jew can and should be a full participant in secular life. Judaism is a religion, and out of this, in the early 19th century, comes this thing called Wissenschaft des Judentum, the science of Judaism, and it's a little bit. It's a little bit let me find this quote. So Mendelssohn and other Maskilim, the Enlightenment types, who were his colleagues and his followers, sought to maintain their Jewish religious identity through Jewish practice that was compatible with the rational scientific world in which they also claimed membership. And it was a very great challenge to have the right balance between these things. And it was especially hard because even though restrictions on Jewish life were lifted, sometimes they were those restrictions were reapplied. It was not easy. It wasn't just suddenly all the Jews were accepted. And so this Wissenschaft idea, this idea of let's study Judaism as a scientific study. We'll study the archaeology and the anthropology and the literary works, and we'll turn it into a subject of study like the classics and like history. And this, the idea was that this would give it a kind of prestige and justify Jews participating in German society. And this is very influential today. It's really the basis, this Wissenschaft idea of the science of Judaism is the basis of Jewish studies departments and the Jewish Theological Seminary. So they wanted to eradicate Yiddish. There was a Hebrew revival in that area. Let's make poetry and literature in Hebrew, and then some of that became the roots of modern Hebrew. But Yiddish needed to be eradicated. So Mendelssohn was anything but reform. That is, he was completely traditional in his practice. But from that, in the 1800s, you get Abraham Geiger, who is understood to be the founder, in some sense, of Reform Judaism. So what he said is, we need to just be proud Germans. And he was called a reformer, and his followers were called reformers. And that was the first official movement in Judaism. So they said, there's no reason, this whole dietary law thing, let's pray in German, not in Hebrew. There was even a movement to move the Sabbath to Sunday. They took off their hats in synagogue because that was what the Christians did. They didn't have yarmulkes or prayer shawls. They focused on the universal messages of the prophets, be a light unto the nations, and they left behind the legal texts, the chosen people, and the yearning for a rebuilt temple. Was it Jewish?
Well, they weren't anything else.
Well, is that right? So was this a way, so you're saying this was a way to sort of protect themselves from having to become Christians?
Well, I mean, they didn't add into that they were going to take Jesus Christ as their Savior, Lord and Savior. Yeah. And so they didn't become Christians.
You know, it's very interesting, actually. There was a lot of
there was some conversion, of course.
There was a lot of conversion to Christianity, sometimes for pragmatic reasons, to get a job or to, you know, fit in, sometimes out of true belief. Interestingly, a lot more women converted than men, because women didn't have the depth of learning in the old world that connected them, made it harder for them to leave. They weren't as connected religiously and you know. So, yeah.
I'd always heard that Reform Judaism was kind of like a response to Christianity.
Well, okay, so look at this list. I mean, it's a response to the dissonance, to the cognitive dissonance of leaving the shtetl and the ghetto, finding yourself in a Christian world, and trying to figure out what it is that you have that's parallel to Christianity. And distilling Judaism down to only those parts that are parallel to Christianity. So it isn't unrelated to
that. Was it, in fact, anything due to the fact that there was so much pressure on conversion there from the Christian society?
I mean, I don't think that's why Reform Judaism came to be. No, the Christians didn't care how the Jews practiced Judaism. They cared, right?
At that point.
Yeah, they cared they might have wanted the Jews to convert, although I don't hear that much about that. Do you know anything about that? Like, was there a lot of evangelical?
I mean, since we're talking about Germany after the Reformation,
right?
And you don't have this corporate universality of mm-hmm. the Catholic Church, you don't have that same pressure to convert, at least not to the same extent.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, but, right.
And I think it was also about being modern and not being these people in long coats and long side hair and right. looking like old-fashioned people.
So, okay. Go ahead.
Well, it was also a reaction to what was happening in Christianity at the same time. The Catholic Church superstition and the priests and the cassocks and the mm-hmm. incense was going away.
Right. Well, and the dominant Christianity in Germany at that time was Protestantism.
Right.
So, they became not like, you're right.
Jewish people saw German Protestants reforming. We wanted to reform too.
Well,
sort of.
I'm not sure I would put it exactly like that. It's not that they saw them reforming. It's that was the Christianity they saw,
right.
and they came out into that,
right.
and they needed to
okay.
somehow find something that was a coherence for themselves in that mode.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to go back to what Marian said when you asked the question. I think her answer was something like, but they didn't. There weren't anything else. And I don't know if this is comparable, but fast forward 100 years, I was raised as a Reformed Jew in 1970 something or mm-hmm. other, okay? So I don't know if my Reformed Judaism bore any resemblance to what you're talking about, but based on what Marian said, there were a lot of people in my congregation who very much needed to keep that Jewish connection, not necessarily for scientific or rational reasons, but because something emotional or traditional,
yep.
and did feel very much yep. that they also needed to do it without non-Jews identifying them.
Mm-hmm.
So I was raised in this enormous Reform congregation near Philadelphia. Enormous meaning like thousands of us, because there weren't a lot of Reform congregations.
Yep.
Therefore, anybody who was Reform within 200 miles,
right, right.
yeah. But
it's so interesting, yeah.
And so, and I think that Reform that I was raised in, and looking at what you're showing us, and the Reform, like my mother's still a member of that congregation. I go
yeah.
back, even though there's probably been some modifications. I think the underlying point Marian kind of maybe encapsulated, so it wasn't supposed to be viewed as rejecting anything.
Yeah.
It was more supposed, and I think you also said, it was more sort of like a protective shell.
Uh-huh.
Like the first Jewish governor of Pennsylvania was Milton Schaap, but it was really Milton Shapiro, and he was a member of our congregation.
Uh-huh.
And it's the whole story about how people in Hollywood kind of
right.
changed their last names
yeah.
and stuff like that. So I just want to emphasize that my perception of what you're describing is
mm-hmm.
not so much rejecting
mm-hmm.
your heritage and
right.
your faith, but
right.
it's more a chance for you to concentrate
yep.
on your Judaism
and
without having to
right.
feel like someone else is like judging
and
you.
And I don't know if some of that was going on in Germany at the time, but in America, this changed so much. And when these things landed in America, America is a nation of immigrants. Right, to have your thing in America that's different from everybody else, it's very different than to have your thing that's different from everybody else in Germany in that period, right? And so I think it has a different flavor. And the other thing is, I think there's a lot of influence when you talk about tradition and preserving tradition and loving to preserve that, I think there was a lot of tradition of influence by that time in Reform Judaism for Mordechai Kaplan. But we'll sort of go get there. So I want to just very briefly go through the rest of the movements, because I just think it's really important for us to realize that it doesn't go, everything was Orthodox, then some people became conservative, and then they lost more and became Reform, and then we came, right? That's not how it happened, right? What, there was this need to figure out how to be a modern Jew, and so there were these reformers that came up, went very far, perhaps too far, and the Reform movement in America made many changes towards something a little bit more traditional. But as a response to that, those reformers, Orthodox Judaism came to be. And Orthodox Judaism was defined as a strong stance against Reform. Samson Raphael Hirsch is kind of the main guy. And he said you can have Torah and the way of the world. You can be modern and fully engaged in Jewish tradition. He didn't wear side curls, right? That issue of wanting, of making sure to fit in, he was going to fit in. And when you see, I mean, you can see all these people in America today, right? You can see the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim, who we now think are the same people, right? The pros and the cons, they both dress like 17th century aristocrats, right? Because they weren't going to change anything, nothing, right? But the modern Orthodox, the Orthodox people, when you go up to Lower Merion and there's all these Orthodox people and they're following Jewish law and they're dressing in a way that's Jewish, but they really look just like the rest of us, except they have a nice little neat kippah that's designed not to stand out too much, and the length of their skirt and the length of their sleeves is a little different. But usually, you know, nowadays you wear leggings and a long jean skirt, so really you can't quite tell. And, you know, so what I'm saying is that's a different kind of, that's orthodoxy. And if you ask my friend Rabbi Eli, who's a Lubavitch Hasid, when people call him orthodox, he goes nuts. He says, I'm not orthodox, I'm just Jewish, right? I'm not orthodox. That's that movement that was developed in Germany by Samson Raphael Hirsch in response to the Reform movement, right? Uh-huh.
I follow the practice of...
Yes, and dox means belief, right? Ortho means straight, and dox means belief, right? So then came conservative Judaism. Zacharias Frankel says change has to happen, but we have to be very careful and rational and not base it on preference or convenience, like how easy it is to get to shul without a car. Okay, so all that happened in Europe. Here is a picture of the population, the Jewish population in Europe since 1939. 1939, 9.5 million Jews. 1945, 3.8 million Jews. 2010, 1.4 million Jews. This isn't where it's happening anymore. This story I've told you happened in Europe, but that's not where it's happening anymore. Now it's happening in America. So each subgroup made a stand in America, and the main way that you make a stand is you create communal and educational institutions. So we have this thing called the Haredim, which means the tremblers before God, and that is the ultra-Orthodox, we call them, but they call themselves Hasidim and Mitnagdim, although they look the same to outsiders, and they are the descendants of these rebbes, and they call themselves by the names of the towns where the rebbe lived. Belts, Bobov, Lvov, Ger, Gerer, Satmar. And the Lithuanian yeshiva culture, yeah.
So within that group, do they know the difference between each other?
Yeah. Yes, they do. Oh my gosh, the semiotics of headgear. You can go on, type that in. It's fascinating. And socks, how high your knee socks are. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Chabad is actually really an interesting movement. So they are Lubavitch Hasidim. Okay? So, you know, one answer to that is they're just Hasidim. They're Hasidic. But they actually merged. So Chabad, the word Chabad is an acronym for Chochma, Bina, and Da'at, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. And it is a very intellectual and learned version of Hasidism. So it's merging two trends. It's not this pure ecstatic, which then becomes really very hierarchical. and it's an outreach organization. It's an organization that says every Jew should taste this. Every Jew should have access to this. And they honestly, I mean, the good ones, honestly, they don't want to turn, they don't get their satisfaction from turning you into a Lubavitcher, into a Chabad person. They get their satisfaction from you having an experience of authentic Judaism under their wing. So they actually, I mean, you know, the good ones. I mean, I'm sure there's some disagreement on that. Okay, so the Reform create the Hebrew Union College in 1875, Modern Orthodox create Yeshiva University in 1886, Conservative create Jewish Theological Seminary in 1886. All at once there, within the space of a few years, all these movements take hold in the United States, and they all change radically over the ensuing 100 years as they try to take in America. And America as it's different from Europe, and these incredible changes that are taking place in the world of science and education and philosophy, because we think that we're part of the of that rational upheaval, but the contemporary version is really interestingly different. And so the way I want to frame Mordechai Kaplan, and you know, this is really my offering here, is that I want to say, okay, so this guy comes along and he creates something. The thing that's unique is that what he creates is, by definition, American. It is American to start with. And let's see if we can figure out what that entails. So he is born in 1881 in Lithuania, where the Mitnagdim flourish, the Litvaks. And the Mitnagdim came to the United States at the age of 8. He had a very, very serious, highest level Jewish traditional education. He became an Orthodox rabbi at a very young age. He helped to found Young Israel, which is really a pillar of the modern, still a pillar of the modern Orthodox movement, the very Orthodox wing of the modern Orthodox movement is Young Israel, and he also studied at CCNY, at JTS, and at Columbia, where he studied all those. He studied philosophy, sociology, education. He got a PhD, and he read John Dewey, and he read Durkheim, and he read sociology and philosophy, and he studied education in the ways it was being taught in the 20th century in America. He taught at JTS for half a century, and he influenced a generation of conservative rabbis. I mean, you know, Rabbi Kaplan, who is the rabbi emeritus at Ohev Shalom, he studied with Rabbi Kaplan, with Mordechai Kaplan, and and was a devotee of Mordechai Kaplan, right? But he's completely within the conservative movement. And Mordechai Kaplan never wanted to create a movement. You've probably heard that before. He thought that what he was creating was American Judaism, and he thought he was he was just Jewish, right? And he was trying to figure out what that means in 20th century America. So his new ideas stemmed from, I've got three general directions here. First is pragmatism. I have some quotes here. I'll put them up on the board. I'll just go through the sort of this outline form, and then maybe we can spend the last few minutes looking at some quotes from Kaplan that maybe can give you an idea of what this pragmatism means. The idea is, when you talk about Judaism, you shouldn't be talking about, it's not about speculation about what you believe, right? It's about what you do, the role that Jewish practice plays in your life. In some ways, I guess what I want to say in terms of justifying my outline here is I want to come back to the beginning and say Mordechai Kaplan thinks that it's about community. So the fact that we're going to end this three sessions with talking about how do you be a Reconstructionist relative to your community, it's not an accident. So he's trying to, what he thinks is that talking about speculation and metaphysics and what God believes, I mean what we believe about God, is beside the point, right? He has this famous phrase, first comes belonging, then comes behaving, and finally maybe comes believing, right? This is much more similar to the world of corporate Judaism than it is to Moses Mendelssohn's Judaism. So it's pragmatic. It's about what you do. He defined the idea of the community center. When we say JCC, 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 the idea that you would get together with a bunch of Jews and play basketball, right, in a Jewish context. That was part of being Jewish, being part of this community, right? He also was influenced by the field of the sociology of religion. He read Durkheim, and he was very impressed with Durkheim. And there also the idea, what that teaches is that it's not just about ideas and beliefs, that religion, that the sancta, the forms of religious life define the forms of community life, and they're not about doing it so God won't punish you or doing it because you believe. They're about doing those things because it's an acting out of a social world that you're part of, and it creates the communal values and the communal structures to act out those things. And so our language, he, unlike the, based on that, what does he think about the reformer plan, the early reformers plan of getting rid of the yarmulke and the, you know, and the tefillin? It's the opposite of what he would want, right? He actually, after he started spending more time studying philosophy than Judaism, he'd get up in the morning, this is in Mel Skolt's biography, and he put tefillin on and then read philosophy. Right? So he's like mixing the Jewish and the modern contemporary American. He was also influenced by evolution. His relationship with sort of Darwinian thought is complicated. Actually, he's a very complicated writer. Reading Mordechai Kaplan is not easy. He wrote volumes and volumes and volumes of very, very long books. And a lot of times it seems like he says different things in different places. So, which is one of the reasons, you know, he never had in mind creating a nice, clear creed that was going to turn into a movement. It was his son-in-law, Ira Eisenstein. I knew that. Okay, it was his son-in-law, Ira Eisenstein, who, I'm just so used to son-in-law, said, look, if we need to have, it's too frustrating not to have a vehicle for bringing these ideas directly into the world. And so he agreed reluctantly. And the look at how late the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, right? All those others were in the 80 years earlier, 80 or 90 years earlier. Society for the Advancement of Judaism. I gave a talk there once.
Two blocks away from the Society for the Advancement of Culture.
Right. And he studied with Adler? Yeah, who started the Ethical Culture Society.
Yeah, totally.
He was of Jewish extraction. So he believed in... I don't want to say he believed in evolution. Science of his time was evolutionary science. Science of his time was data-based science as opposed to purely deductive science. And it was always looking toward the evolving emergent thing. And so his famous line, he has a book called Judaism as Civilization. He describes Judaism as the evolving religious civilization of the Jews. And there's no doubt in my mind that he's right about that. I don't know what else it could be. And the points I was making at the beginning about the Bible and the Mishnah and Maimonides all being, not making any sense except in response to the moment that they came to be in, right? And so, but what you do with that, of course, is up for question. And whether we have unfolded Reconstructionism in the best way and in the right way, and I'm not going to take sides on that right now. I think we have a long way to go to figure that out. Right.
After the Enlightenment.
Well, monotheism, right? Christianity arguably monotheism. Yeah, but just because it also is doesn't mean you're not Jewish.
Well, I mean, I think that Joyce's question is in some ways the question, right? I mean, I think that is the question. What is Judaism and what is authentic Judaism?
And it's also what is a Jew.
Right. I mean, presumably those are related questions. I think, like, maybe that's what we should spend our last 15 minutes talking about instead. I have some Kaplan quotes here that, are kind of interesting. They're a little long-winded, but if you want, we can read them and think about them a little bit. These are actually all from one perspective, unfortunately, but they're sort of the question of one of the gripes I have is that people say, oh, Reconstructionists don't believe in God, or something like that, right? We don't believe in supernaturalism. We don't believe in blah, blah, blah. And that doesn't seem to me to be quite in the spirit of Kaplanian thinking or my personal thinking, and which I don't want to claim that those are the same thing by any means, but and so this idea, I'm fascinated by this idea of I guess in order to come talk to you guys, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what is it that's pragmatic, that's functional about his thinking. Do you know what I mean? It's like, in what way, and that's American pragmatism. That's so, so quintessentially American. You know, we just, don't give me all this theory. Tell me what good it does, right? What's the use of it, right? That's what I want to know. So I was trying to figure out, well, how does that apply to Judaism? And I found all this little cache of quotes that seemed to me to talk about that problem of belief in a way that undercuts the whole question of, oh, do we or don't we believe in supernaturalism, and gets into this functional definition, functional way of talking about God. So that's what I put here. So maybe we should, does somebody want to read that? I'm tired of talking into the microphone. I mean, you'll see, and these aren't like necessarily pithy, but. don't work. This is from a book called The Meaning of God, this first one. Well, Debbie worships the microphone. You want to use this one?
Both buttons, yeah. Belief in God, as here conceived, can function in our day exactly as the belief in God has always functioned. It can function as an affirmation that life has value.
So it has that function.
That life has value. It implies, as the God idea has always implied, a certain assumption with regard to the nature of reality. The assumption that reality is so constituted as to endorse and guarantee the realization in man of that which is of greatest value to him. If we believe that assumption to be true, as has been said, it is an assumption that is not susceptible of proof. We have faith in God. No metaphysical speculation beyond this fundamental assumption that reality assures both the emergence and the realization of human ideals is necessary for the religious life.
Richard Remnick would like to respond.
It's a nice try. It doesn't work.
Why not?
I don't believe. Because he's saying, you know, he's talking about function, he's talking about pragmatism, and then he turns right around in the same breath. He says value.
Yes. Well, I mean, so... right. Actually, that's great. Richard, could you read the next quote? Well, there's a lot in the first one. I'm going to mention some important phrases from the first one. So, life has value. An affirmation that life has value. The God idea has always implied that reality is constituted in a way that guarantees that people can strive for and hope to reach what is most of greatest value to them.
Which is what?
Well, okay, maybe this next one. Let's try to read the next one as a definition of the first one. I don't know, is it? Maybe. Well, I think his idea is that the community is going to do that together.
Okay.
I think that's his idea, and that humanity is going to do it. And he's looking for, I mean, the thing that is most, like, I think going to sound weird to you guys is his emphasis on the word salvation. He thinks that God is the power that makes motion toward salvation possible. Now, It does mean that you have to have your own values. And this is a problem with Deweyan education, right? Deweyan education, the kid should just learn according to how his learning unfolds. But what if he doesn't get to where he can read and write and do arithmetic, right? So, I mean, it is a problem, right? What? Good values and spirituality. And he's saying no. He's saying spirituality assumes values. And here he's going to add another word in, the fifth word in this next sentence.
Ultimately, the forces for good that inhere,
good.
That inhere in the world and in human nature will give rise to a just social order. One in which every human being will be able to achieve the full measure of self-realization and accord to his neighbor the same right and opportunity.
I'm pretty sure that exact sentence is in Marx somewhere, but okay.
Yeah. The evolution of mankind, though marred by frequent and disheartening reactions, moves irresistibly in the direction of universal security and freedom.
This is before the Holocaust, by the way.
From the standpoint of the Jewish religion, ethical purpose does not emerge merely as an incident of social history, but is a directive and creative force.
He believes that the world contains a kind of a creative unfolding toward good, and that that's what God is. But it doesn't mean that there's a clear endpoint. It has to do it on its own. So this is, I think, where he isn't quite a Darwinian, because Darwinian, although maybe he is, because Darwin...
He's not a social Darwinist.
No, he's certainly not a social Darwinist. But Darwin says the one who survives is the one who has the right move for the future, right? It's about the future. It's not about the present or the past, right? And so Darwin isn't the most important way to parse Kaplan, but he has this idea that there's an unfolding, and the evolving civilization is one that unfolds toward the good. That feels a little supernatural to me.
Christianity, in addition to believing Jesus is the Son of God and God and has these divine qualities, also believes that all humans are born in sin, which is the opposite of what he's talking about.
Very nice. Very nice.
So,
that's really.
But
nice
you're right. Point. This guy, it's like just when you figure him out, the next sentence comes up and you're like,
right.
Whoa, I don't get it anymore.
So read this next one.
Under progress?
This is from a book called The Religion of Ethical Nationhood, Judaism's Contribution to World Peace. I don't know if that's a... Yeah, I guess.
Unlike other living creatures, man must take a hand in his own metamorphosis. He must consciously and deliberately share in the cosmic or divine process which impels him to become fully human. The nature of man, far from being a finished affair, is still in the making. Just as modern man is an improvement over the caveman, maybe, so his continued development may be assumed in the process of emergent evolution.
So he definitely has this kind of Hegelian or Marxist vision of actually unfolding toward a grand salvation. And it is metaphysical, and progress cannot mean for us a definitive approach to a static final goal. That's what people would say saves him from the truly metaphysical. Yeah. You want to pass the mic back? We need the mic. We can't hear you.
These ideas are also present in Buddhism.
That's true.
I mean, it's not, been in Buddhism for a long time.
And he might say that the sancta with which you undertake these processes. I mean, these quotes are all from this point of view of this. They're really on the topic of is he interested in metaphysics and belief? Maybe ironically not, maybe ironically so. There's lots of other things he talks about, and one of the things he talks about is that the particular, and this is very Durkheimian, sociology of religion kind of stuff, the particular sancta, the particular forms in which you and with your community approach and work toward these goals, that's what makes you who you are and gives you identity. So Buddhism would have certain ways of doing these things. And you know, I don't know, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but to figure out what are the Jewish ways, and he wanted, you know, he was so completely steeped in and knowledgeable about the Jewish sancta, the Jewish forms of sanctified life. He didn't really need any other input. But maybe we do, you know, maybe if we recognize in Buddhism some other possibilities to help us turn our Jewish community into one that's moving in these directions toward the good, maybe those become integrated into our sancta. I mean, it won't be the first time that ever happened. And let's finish with this last one, if somebody wants to read that.
The main purpose of the opening chapter of the Torah is not to give an account of creation, but to teach that the world, as God created it, is a fit place for man to achieve his godlikeness or salvation.
So, I mean, it's a good news philosophy. And it doesn't really tell us where to go, but really my job was to get us to America. And that's what I hope I did by saying, here's this new form that in some ways goes back to the old form, and in some ways America, by the way, let me just say again, America is a nation of immigrants. And it may be, at least in Kaplan's mind, and maybe for real, maybe there's a possibility here of creating, of really having a Jewish community within the American community. You know, maybe we can figure that out here. And maybe this is the only place you could figure that out. How to be really modern, that is to say, really part of a free nation that recognizes the value of the individual, but also has real community. I don't know, maybe. Anyway, that's the kind of authenticity that I think we need to seek. And we can only do it together. And nothing about Reconstructionism as it got defined by Kaplan, as it got defined. By the way, Dewey wrote this book called Reconstruction in Philosophy. He's like, Reconstruction in Judaism, you know, it's like, and then Reconstructionism gets created really when there's a rabbinical school to teach rabbis to be that, and community, you know, and a community structure to make synagogues that are affiliated with that, and, you know, then nothing about that as it gets kind of reified, made actual, is set in stone. I mean, by definition, it evolves. And it may evolve into something that's more traditional, and that has more opportunities for community life, separate from the rest of America. I don't know. But next time, Rabbi Linda will talk about how prayer folds in, you know, what the challenges are of being a prayer in that in this modern world and in and how Reconstructionism works with that. And then Rabbi Nathan will sort of, I mean, I hope, demonstrate some communal processes.
Thank you.
Do you want to, one last?
Yeah, just a little question. There was, you spent a lot of time talking about the importance of the community center.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't quite sure how there was the jump from the community center to let's go form a rabbinical college.
Well, that's the impetus of the community center is part of what he's saying. The reason I emphasize that is that he thinks community life in its wholeness,
correct,
is where Judaism is going to live.
Correct.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
Sit
tight just a second.
A nice sort of supplement to what has been said tonight will be occurring on Sunday from 11 to 1, where we're going to have our little talk called Moving On from Never Again. And this is going to be with Rabbi Stephen Guteau, who's a very prominent community activist, but also a graduate of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College.
He's a fantastic guy.
Yeah.
One of the nicest people in the whole wide world.
And Rabbi Joshua Guteau, who is from Graz College. And I think at least a little bit of what they have to say will be an extension of this question of where do we go? How do we make ourselves as Jews in this situation? So
thank you.
I hope to see all of you there.
I'm going to be out of town.
11 to 1 Sunday, Helen.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher kidshanu b'mitzvotav etzivanu al sfirat haomer. Hayom arba'a ve'esrim yom shehem shlosha shavuot u'shlosha yamim la'omer. In case you were wondering, we just counted the omer. The number is 24. We're on our way to 49, and then number 50 is Shavuot. We're marching from Passover to Shavuot and counting the days. Thank you all very much. Thanks.